You are listening to a sermon by Ron Reed, recorded on Sunday, April 28, 2019, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Folks, you might want to shift over there. We're going to look at some pictures here, so if you can see them, you're set, and otherwise, and they're much more interesting than what I have to say. Yeah, 2006, a long time ago, was a bad year for me. It was hard at my theater. We all go through these times when things are not playing out very well. I lost my general manager at the theater, so I ended up doing that job. And over the 35 years of my theater's history, I've ended up sort of running the company probably two-thirds of the time, off and on. And what I want to do is act and write and direct plays and choose plays for our season. But well, more than half the time I've been called on to also run the business of the company. And we're all called on to do things that we don't really want to do. I mean, that's why it's a job. That's why we get paid to do it sometimes. But I find that the pull between who, at the deepest part of me, God has made me to be an artist, the pull between that and the practicalities of meetings and staff recruitment and budgets and those kinds of things doesn't bring out the best in me. I'm not as nice to be around. That's maybe the worst part of it of all for me. It's one thing to feel rather unhappy or frustrated. It's another when you realize that in your frustration, you're making other people's lives unpleasant. And then I'm very hard on myself for that. So I was feeling pretty low. I'd say though, and really, I guess I'd say I felt responsible for everything at the theater. And in general, that can be a tendency for me as a firstborn, prairie, Norwegian, Canadian, Christian, from a nice family. I can tend to take on any responsibility that comes my way. And spiritually, I had made the mistake of kind of looking in the rearview mirror and remembering what my faith was when I was a brand new Christian, the radicalness of it. The way that it was so new and fresh, the things that Jesus said and called us to seemed so different than the kind of comfortable middle-class life that I was growing up into. And as a, I guess, 15-year-old who was into radical politics, it just seemed the most exhilarating, dangerous, adventurous call that I could imagine. At the start of 2007, I was turning 50, and I looked around me and I was living the comfortable, safe, middle-class life that I thought I had been called away from. And when I look back at, and when I read the Gospels through the lens of my 15-year-old eyes, I thought, was I even a disciple at all? I felt like I was not following radically what Jesus would have for me. I felt very compromised. I didn't understand really my faith or how I fit into it. I was quite troubled. I just wasn't living up to anything that I thought God had for me or that I had for myself. At the start of 2007, I turned 50, and two friends took me to New York City for the first time. That's friends, right? When for your birthday, they take you to New York. And we ended up at the Frick Gallery. I don't know if you've been there, but it's not like the kind of galleries we think of, a very institutional sort of place. It's in a home. Now, this home is worth tens of millions of dollars. It's a mansion sitting next to Central Park. Nonetheless, you walk into various rooms and you're standing this close to paintings. You might be the only person in the room. And all the great painters are represented. It's an extraordinary thing. It feels personal and intimate in a way that an institutional gallery doesn't. Yep. So, here we are. I walked into one long room and was kind of wandering around, was already a little bit in awe of what I was seeing. And it was a great big long room. And at the end of this long room, there was a really big painting that you can see right there. I suppose that would be big enough. The actual painting is about 6 feet tall. It's as tall as I was. I guess the bottom of it's about here. So it filled, and it's how much wider? That might even be squished in a little bit. It's massive. When you stand in front of the painting, it's all you see. It's your whole field of vision. It's by Claude Lorraine. It's called The Sermon on the Mount. It's almost 9 feet wide. It's a landscape. It was painted about 370 years ago. This guy was born in France. He moved to Italy where he learned to paint. It's a painting of the Holy Land, but he never traveled to the Holy Land, except in his imagination. So for Claude Lorraine, the Holy Land looked a lot like Italy. There's a lot going on in this picture. On the right-hand side, there's this distant mountain. That represents Mount Lebanon, rising above the Sea of Galilee. And then on the left, down near us in the other corner, that's the Dead Sea with the River Jordan running down into it. In the center is probably Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration. So you can see that he has painted kind of a panorama of all these significant sites in the Holy Land in one painting. You'd never see them all in one view, but in his imagination he could. And in a way, as we'll see in a bit, the painting also seems to travel through time and touching different... It's a panorama of Jesus' life as well as being a panorama of the Holy Land. But that Mount of Transfiguration in the center there, Claude Lorraine is using that as the setting for the Sermon on the Mount. That more likely happened on another mountain, the Mount of Beatitudes. It was on the northwest shore of the Galilee. But again, Claude had never been there, except in his imagination. And then it's very hard to tell with the low contrast here. So I've booked us all flights to New York. So you'll have time to go home and pack, and I'll meet you at the airport, and we'll go and have a really good look. But way up here, this is a painting about the Sermon on the Mount. Well,
whoops.
If you touch that, it disappears. So you'll have to be much more careful. Yeah, well, there you are. We've zoomed in now. That's Jesus and his disciples on top of the Sermon on the Mount. He's in the scope of the whole painting. He's just this little tiny thing, and we'll zoom back out and see again. So there he is talking to his disciples, gathered in close around him. But he's very far away. So if we zoom back out, we can see. So there's Jesus in his blue robe. I will try not to touch it so it goes away again. Way up there, there's Jesus. And gather around her, all these people doing all kinds of things. There's various examples. Down on the left, way down in here, we can see there's people worshiping. So again, you start getting a sense of the detail. When you look at the whole thing, especially in our kind of smudgy version here, hard to see, but here's people who are got their hands raised, kind of in worship, reaching out. But in the same time, here's someone with their hands up like this. But there's all kinds of other things going on as well. So in this corner, you've got some really devout people who are clearly worshiping and adoring Jesus. Back here's a boat. It looks like... Huh?
Oops, sorry.
Can you go back?
Yes.
Yeah. So up there, you get a boat with... And when you look at it, it looks like it could be a fishing boat, a big fishing boat, like in the Sea of Galilee. It could be the boat that Jesus preached from. here's a strange little cave that's kind of, none of it's explained. He didn't give sort of liner notes to this or anything. But a lot of people, I thought, and it seems a lot of people think that could be the open tomb, the open, representing the open grave from Easter morning. If we widen out again, we can see these people. That they're just this little detail down here, yes? And there's the grave. We've got all this. And if we zoom in again, there's some more people over here that are kind of paying close attention. So they're obviously, some of them seem to be worshiping Jesus. They're all kind of looking up there, but they're not all looking up there. We'll see some others, but I also want to start pointing out the fact that around these folks, there's these sheep. So if we widen it out a little bit more, you can see more sheep, more people. And the thing that started to strike me as I stood there in front of this painting was, yes, there were the people who were really focused on Jesus and recognizing him for who he was and worshiping him and adoring him and reaching out and listening. But you've also got these people here kind of looking back at somebody else and looking back there, who knows what for. There's these sheep that are, there's sheep that are looking kind of that way and sheep that are looking this way. And I started to think, it's sort of more like people at a picnic. Like some people are watching the thing that's going on and some people are chatting and some people are hanging with their sheep. And the people started to remind me of the sheep. You know, some looking that way, some looking that way, some looking that way, some looking that way. They're just kind of gathered on the hillside. There's Jesus with probably the most famous and important sermon, section of teaching ever given in the world. And people are kind of having a picnic and the sheep are kind of looking around and they all look like a kind of an unruly bunch of sheep. I zeroed in on the most attentive sheep. But if you spend some time with the painting, you kind of go, you could almost take Jesus out of the picture at the top there. And for half the people and half the sheep, it wouldn't make that much difference. But there's this beautiful sense of a peace. So if we go to the next picture, even more sheep spread out all down the hill. You start to get this sense of the people picnicking, the people looking around. And I began to think, with the people and the sheep echoing each other, I started to think about the fact that we are his people and the sheep of his pasture. And of course, all these scriptures and songs about being sheep, we sing them. I think we quickly jump to the meaning. Like, oh, that means this. I interpret it that way. This is who I am. But to just stand in front of a painting and just look at people and sheep, I started thinking about what sheep are like. And maybe that's okay with God that I'm just one of the sheep of his pasture. Well, let's take in the whole scene again. Let's go to the full picture. So here we have this whole picture. Jesus, that little, and when you see the painting live, there's that little bit of this royal blue in Jesus' robes. And yes, there's blue in the sea and more of an aquamarine or something, all this. And then your eye can't help but pick up this. Down in the bottom right-hand corner, there is this blue of this guy's robe and his son's robe. So that's one thing that takes your eye down to the corner. And another is that they are tremendously bigger because of perspective. They are by far the closest thing to us. And I would say that anyone looking at the painting for any amount of time would start with the big mountain in the middle, kind of looking at Jesus, maybe pick out details. You inevitably are going to end up looking at that guy and his little family, his wife, his, I think, boy, maybe girl, dog, curled up, sleeping, and his sheep. And there he is, just sitting there, looking. There's his family. He's got his blue pants, his son's dressed in blue. And there's this shepherd with his elbow on his knee and his chin in his hand, is listening to this man in blue on this distant hilltop, who's speaking these strange blessings The man's kind of bemused. He's peaceful. He's out of his depth. But he looks comfortable, comforted. He's just taking it all in. What he doesn't understand is right there alongside what he sort of understands. But you saw how far away they are. He can't even be catching all the words. Do you remember, if you know Monty Python's Life of Brian, there's a scene with the where somebody's sort of standing at the back of the crowd, kind of hearing the Sermon on the Mount, and he kind of goes, "Blessed are the cheesemakers." Whatever's getting through, he's just picking up some of it. He's never read this in his Bible. He doesn't have a New Testament. There isn't one yet. But certainly he hears the tone of voice. Here's this sort of gentle, calm, authoritative, but not bullying sort of shepherd voice. So there's this simple man. He's surrounded by his little family, his sheep, an inconsequential person. He's surrounded by other people who seem either to understand it more than he does or not be paying attention at all. But he just lets these words just flow around him and into him. He's not striving and straining to hear this. He's not arguing. They're not discussing. He's not figuring it all out. Most of them, certainly in him, there's not even this sense of adoration and worship and recognition. He just receives. And he's at peace. It's a beautiful day. He senses this is one of the most important times in all eternity. That this is, in fact, eternity. And always, or at least for quite a few centuries, he can just sit on the grass there, just tucked away in the bottom right-hand corner of this painting, surrounded by the quietness of the Frick Gallery, and just take it all in. For hundreds of years, the grass, the water, the sunlight, his wife, his boy, his sheep, and Jesus. And I felt like he was my friend, this shepherd, this guy who God said to me as I stood there that day, that actually maybe was me, that it was okay to just be a guy just sitting and listening to a voice, to just be a shepherd who's pretty hard to tell apart from his sheep, a sheep who knows his shepherd's voice, doesn't catch all the words, but catches their drift as they drift away on the breeze. Comfort, comfort my people. Your hard service has been completed. Welcome to the picnic on the mount. So I told you that 2006 was a pretty bad year for me. Well, 2007 was worse. I set up a leadership team at the theater, and I switched back to halftime so I could write a book I was working on about film. But that imploded. Things at the theater went sideways, so Ron to the rescue again. Now, I hadn't planned any acting or writing for a whole season so that I could write this book. But now I'm not going to get to write the book either. I'm nothing but a under duress arts administrator. So by December of 2007, I felt a real desperation, just a sense of panic, of stress, anxiety. The lights started to go on. and I was, maybe we'll leave that off if we
there's
can.
There's more. Yeah.
Because there's more to come.
More to come.
I was going to a counselor at that time who was a real lifeline. And he wanted me every morning when I woke up to start with a bit of a time with God. I think it's so that I didn't leap to email and worries first thing out of bed. It was a bit of a buffer maybe, but it also set things right. And being Advent, there were a number of texts in a row about do not be afraid, don't be alarmed. And I was living with fear and alarm a lot of the time. I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. And I started to wonder, what are the shepherd's rod and staff? How do they comfort me? And my mind somehow went to one of my favorite films, a film called Rivers and Tides. Do you want to hit that little button there?
Got it.
Beautiful. I wrote in my journal, "This morning I was wondering what a shepherd's rod and staff might be. I learned that the rod is maybe a club to drive away predators, but the staff is sort of what you would think of, a shepherd's crook. But we think it's like a walking stick. You know, you kind of stride along like Gandalf or sort of a picturesque thing for shepherds to lean on, you know, where they contemplate their peaceful flocks of soft woolly lambs, sort of like the last picture. But we're going to see a shepherd with his staff." This is in Scotland. There's his staff. There's a little sheep, a lamb. Oh, and here's a sheep. And that's what he does.
And here's the other one. What is it?
Because here's another lamb. She's still panicky. She's still running around in terror. So he steps away a few feet. She calms down, comes in and starts tending to her second little baby. "The Lord is my shepherd. He makes me to lie down. My rod and staff, they comfort me." But comfort doesn't so much mean make us comfortable, as it means, well, keep us from harm, something like that. Like when a sheep wanders toward a dangerous valley, the shepherd can use that staff to grab that stupid, stubborn, panicky little guy and just haul him back to safety. There's something aggressive about it. There's something fierce about that staff. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Let's look at that again. So she is in the state that I was, panicky, running around, trying to do everything, terrified, and consequently not really able to get around to doing the thing that she's there to do. Grabs her, throws her to the ground.
Here's the other one. What is it?
He kind of holds her down on the ground with the weight of his body, pulls her out, pulls out the little one. And you can stop it. The fear and the panic that I can tend to feel, I kind of wind myself up and scramble around. Notice that when the sheep lets her up, she practically tramples her new baby in her scramble to get away from the shepherd. But he retreats so she can calm down and tend to her baby. And here's that image again. Just about crushing the little guy. Because the shepherd stopped her, pulled her to the ground, made her rest. Something's born. And I began to think of God pulling me to the ground, putting his knee on my neck, stopping me from my panic. So I just had to lay there on the earth and breathe. And then this thing could be born. This little baby. We'll move forward a few more years to 2016. It's the Saturday after Easter, so we're almost a decade later. And I'm going through another time of discontent, feeling kind of critical of things, critical of people, self-critical, restless, just craving some kind of renewal, some kind of refreshment. And you know, at the root of it, though I don't think I realized it, I had lost track of heaven. this optimism, this hope, this confidence that in the future lies something better, some time of being closer to God. You know, as a brand new Christian, I had this complete confidence in eternity, in heaven. I wasn't afraid of death. It's like, it's going to be even better. So I'll stick around here, of course, but be happy enough to get on with things after. But somehow over the years, as I'd grown more tired or whatever it was, it seemed very distant. I felt very unsure about those things. I guess the hope had shrunk and I wasn't sure that heaven was even a real thing. Partly, I wasn't even sure that I wanted to go there. There's that scripture that was one of my least favorite that said, you've been responsible in many things. Now I will, in heaven, and I will put you in charge of cities. And I thought, wow. So I ended up having to administrate a theater company for a few decades, and it just about killed me. When it actually does kill me, I'll go to heaven, and I'll have a bigger job. I thought, just, is there an option? Like, I wonder if I can negotiate another deal here. What's the other guy got to offer? But mostly, though, and I make light of that, but there was part of me that kind of wondered, really, like, is it going to be more of the same? Do I have to keep being that guy? But mostly, heaven was just intangible. It was a dream. So, the Saturday after Easter, I found myself at a contemplative service at Fairview Baptist Church. It was a contemplative service that was held once a month. Rob D. Coates led it. And because it was contemplative, there would be a simple reading, a simple song, and then a long stretch to just sit. So I found that my attention started to gravitate to the stained glass window in the west end of the church that we were facing. Now, this doesn't exactly do it justice. It was late evening, things were getting dim, and the window was straight in the west end, so the low light was hitting that. And stained glass is remarkable. These were deep, deep blue colors. And when the late evening light hits this deep blue, it radiates the most remarkable color. It's maybe like blue in heaven. And I kept looking at this, and I started to see there were the sheep. And this piece of blue shone out more than anything else, this water down here. And it was the most extraordinarily inviting, calm, peaceful place. Isaiah 40, he tends his flock like a shepherd. He holds the little lambs in his arms. He'll carry them in his bosom and gently lead those that are with young. Well, I was there because my friend, Rob D. Coates, was dying. Rob had led these services. He had established these contemplative services. He had been my first friend in Vancouver when I moved here in 1978. I had lots of friendly friends. But he arrived here from Montreal, and he was still three-quarters hippie, and I gave him his first modern English Bible because he had a King James, which is fine, but he wasn't making much sense of it. So I got him a modern language Bible, and we would sing Bob Dylan songs, we would listen to Miles Davis, and we would read the Bible together. Became very close friends. Over the years, we had seen each other less and less. He found really his calling at building a worldwide community of contemplative Christians. And I had found mine in running my theater company. We crossed paths now and then. Then I got word he had cancer for some time, and it had come to the point where this would probably be the last service that he would lead. My wife went to them occasionally, and she let me know this. And I wasn't sure I would go. I didn't think it would be right to go just to see my friend. Like, either I was going to the contemplative service to meet God, but to just kind of, I don't know, it felt funny. But I decided that I should go. that God had something there for me. Rob sat up at the front, but he usually led the services, but this time he said not to worry. He said he was very tired, but he wasn't going to lead the service, but he wanted, so he played his guitar and sat in a kind of a circle of chairs with a couple other musicians, recorder player. He didn't lead the songs, he was just there. And I would notice during the readings and the silent times, he would just be looking out at everybody. But he wasn't kind of looking, kind of going, yo, Tim, dude, catch you after the service. Rosie, hey, everybody. He was just looking at us almost like through a thin curtain or the other side of a pane of glass, just watching. And I felt free to just kind of see him looking at us as I was looking at him as he was looking at us. There was one point where he kind of looked toward me and I saw not kind of a, yo, Ron, good to see you, dude, just kind of regarding each other. And he also had said, look, he said, don't worry, at some point during your service, I'll probably leave because I'll be tired and it won't serve anyone if I sit here. So he said, at some point I'll go and don't be alarmed. I'm okay. So I was sitting sort of here in the church, looking up there, and then Rob was sitting down here. And at a certain point, toward the end of the service, Rob gets up from his seat and he walks over here, and down off to the side was the door. And I watched Rob walk up and over there and open the door, just walk through the door closed behind him. And I imagined Rob stepping out of this scene into that one and just sitting down among the sheep, probably with his guitar. And I just felt the deepest possible certainty that Rob hadn't gone there yet, but that he would within days. And that was almost like a photograph, not just a stained glass window. And I felt so glad for Rob. So to see your friend for the last time before he's gone, shouldn't that be a sad thing? And I have had those times of feeling very, very sad to lose someone. And I just, in spite of myself, I felt the deepest joy and reassurance as I looked at this old-fashioned stained glass window and imagined my friend sitting there beside these quiet waters. And after all the pain of years with cancer, after all the work, just sitting with the shepherd by the still waters. And I thought, the kingdom of God is this upside down place. I went there thinking I would see my dying friend just before he died, and I came away alive again. So much of what I described had just been healed away. It had calmed down. And later I wrote that it still persists, this pervasive sense of being back at the center of my life. No idea why I'd been so prickly and discontent for too long, why peace and joy had been so elusive, but something shifted, and it stayed shifted. And it felt like a parting gift, really, from my friend. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.